Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the WilmerHale teleconference. No more EU-US privacy safe harbor. What does it mean? During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. If at any time during the conference you need to reach an operator, please press star zero. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Friday, October 9, 2015. I would now like to turn the conference over to today's speakers. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us for today's teleconference on the European Court of Justice's decision in Schrems versus Data Protection Commissioner. This is Ben Powell of WilmerHale, and I'm going to moderate today's program. We have a great discussion planned this afternoon, but first I want to encourage anyone who's participating today to pick up the phone or email us when you come across challenging issues or developments and want to discuss what these developments mean for your company. We want to be helpful wherever possible. Today, I'm joined here today by four of my colleagues from the WilmerHale Privacy and Cybersecurity Practice. First, Martin Braun, a partner in our Frankfurt and Brussels offices. Barry Hurwitz, a partner in our Washington, D.C. office. Hans Kamen, a partner in our Brussels and Frankfurt offices. And Heather Zachary, a partner here in the Washington, D.C. office. Today's discussion is going to, as I mentioned, cover the ECJ decision in Schrems versus Data Protection Commissioner, which invalidated an important mechanism for transferring data from Europe to the United States and created legal uncertainty for U.S. and EU companies that handle EU personal information. We'll discuss what led to the decision, how the EU data protection authorities are reacting, and what companies can do to avoid disruption in their vital transatlantic data flows. I'll note that we've structured this a bit differently from other webinars that you may have attended at WilmerHale. Given the recent developments of this week, we thought we would have a conversation about this decision and its implications rather than a more formal presentation. A quick note, as was mentioned, the call is being recorded and will be made available to you within the next week. And with that, let me start the discussion among my colleagues. Before we talk about the particular decision, I thought we should just take one moment to go over the basics. First, maybe to you, Heather, what is Safe Harbor and why is it important?
Thanks, Ben, and hello everyone on the phone. I know many of you are already very well versed in the Safe Harbor regime, and I don't want to stand between you and the insights and some of the practical advice that we are going to be giving today, but you know, some of the folks on the line are fortunate enough not to have to already be mired deep in the weeds on this stuff. So I'll provide just a really quick primer to situate everybody, make sure we're all on the same page. So, you know, many folks in the EU, the data protection authorities in the EU, think that the United States has, quote, inadequate data protection laws. You know, to them, we are the wild, wild west over here. And I think, you know, Barry can correct me, but I think, you know, many of us who deal with U.S. privacy laws on a daily basis would quibble with that assessment, but we can table that very lively debate for another day. So basically, the fact remains that the EU has deemed U.S. law to be inadequate for the protection of the privacy of personal data of EU data subjects. And given that, companies are prevented from freely transferring personal data about EU data subjects from the European Union to the United States. And that includes not just data about customers and consumers, but also personal data about company employees, about business contacts, suppliers, etc. So in every case when you're transferring personal data of that sort, you need some method of legitimizing the data transfer from the EU to a third country, and here, of course, the United States. So there are a variety of options. We'll be diving into more detail to provide guidance on these later in the call, so I'll just touch on them here. One option is derogations, so you can get the consent of the data subject, for example. There are other exceptions to some of the more time-consuming options for transfers. Another one is one you've probably heard of, the model contractual clauses or the standard contractual clauses. It's essentially a form contract that the EU has approved that is between a data exporter in the EU and a data importer in a third country, can be the United States. Another option is binding corporate rules. But the reason we're here and talking about this is that a really popular option is called the safe harbor regime. US-EU, Swiss-US, and essentially, under the safe harbor regime, what a U.S. company does is it voluntarily promises to comply with certain principles that are designed to approximate EU law. And so you self-certify that you're going to participate with the Department of Commerce. You take a number of substantive steps, some procedural steps, auditing steps when you sign up, and then each year thereafter. And then you were deemed to provide an adequate level of data protection for these cross-border data transfers. And I would mention, I said it was voluntary, but under the safe harbor regime, once you sign up, the principles were enforced by the Federal Trade Commission for most companies, Department of Transportation for, you know, air carriers, some other folks. And if you strayed, you could be subject to a deceptive and unfair trade practice. So that was the very, very short version. I've zoomed through a lot of nuance there, but that's a nutshell. But I don't know, Barry, if you have anything to add to that.
No, I would add only that the safe harbor was attractive to many U.S. companies, and I'm sure many on the line, because it provided a formulation of EU data protection that was more readily digestible by a U.S. audience. The requirements under the safe harbor were specified under an agreement with the U.S. Department of Commerce. They were laid out in a fairly succinct form and allowed U.S. companies to deal with EU data protection requirements under a regime that was, to a degree, Americanized. And that's what made it attractive to many companies, particularly companies that did not otherwise have significant dealings in the European Union.
Hans, you have significant experience representing clients before the European Court of Justice, and I wondered if you perhaps could take us through what did the court do with it in their decision, and what did the court actually decide in the decision?
Yeah, many thanks, and hello to everybody from Frankfurt here. Perhaps one word before I go into the details of the decision. The decision was, for those familiar with the court, not a real surprise, as the court in its recent judgments has very intensively enforced citizens' rights for data protection. We have seen other judgments recently, the Google Spain judgments and others, and there's a clear a tendency in the court to very strictly enforce data protection rights of citizens in the Union. So what was this about? This was about as you all know, an Austrian student who wanted Facebook to not to transfer his data into the U.S., who then made a complaint to the Irish Data Protection Authority, the Irish Data Protection Commissioner, who then, based on a legal act of the European Union, a decision by the European Commission, which basically implemented the commitments given by the U.S. to provide an adequate level of protection, had put that into legal effect in the European Union, and the Data Protection Commissioner basically said, I am bound to that commission decision, and therefore I cannot proceed with your complaint. The student brought an action before the Irish courts, up to the Irish High Court, which then deferred the question to the European Court of Justice whether a national data protection authority has the discretion, despite the existing, normally legal binding European Union Act, to look into the question whether adequate level of protection is ensured. And that was basically the main question. The court said, yes, the National Data Protection Authority does not only have the right, but basically the obligation to make a proper assessment on adequate level of protection, even though there is an existing legal act on the European on the European level which determines that there is such adequate level of protection. And that enabled the European Court of Justice to look into the substance of that decision, and it declared the European Commission decision as illegal because it had basically not established that the standard in the US met the standard of or the laws of the U.S. did not meet the standard of protection as established by the European Court of Justice. That is, in a nutshell, I think the decision. It means basically there is no European Commission decision in effect anymore. There is discussion on whether this is ex tunc or ex nunc. Normally, invalidation is ex tunc, which means has retroactive effect from the beginning of the adoption of that decision. Whether this has any retroactive effect needs to be seen, but it's certain that as from now on, any transfer into the U.S. not covered by any derogations which Heather mentioned before under the directive, consent, standard clauses, and so on and so forth, measures we discuss later on, is basically illegal under European Union law.
So, big decision. Martin or Hans, where are we with the data protection authorities in terms of what they are saying in terms of guidance on whether they're going to initiate investigations or the alternatives? What are they saying is the next steps then for the data protection authorities who, as I understand from Hans's summary, are now empowered, at least now, to initiate investigations in response to complaints or on their own?
Yes, hello everybody. This is Martin Braun in Frankfurt. The decision was kind of to be expected because the court has an expert that kind of makes a suggestion on how the court should decide, the Advocate General, and the Advocate General had taken very similar views to this week's decision beforehand. So in a way, it wasn't totally surprising, but of course now that the decision is out, everybody was impressed, and there was also some hope that if the court would invalidate the safe harbor, they would at least say it can stand another 3 months or 6 months, which the court did not do. As Hans-Georg said, it's over. The data protection authorities, many of them have issued kind of press releases. This is a milestone for data protection in Europe, and we will have to carefully and quickly determine what's next. The current status is that I know that the German data protection authorities on the state level and the federal level sitting together today, president of the French authority, the CNIL, has made some statement, and she's the chairperson of the so-called Article 29 Working Party, which is basically a club of all of the EU data protection authorities, and they have also indicated that they would have some meetings this week and a plenary meeting next week. So I think there is a quite significant likelihood that there will be some kind of unified EU data protection authority press release or statement or paper on what in general they are planning to do. The authorities are independent, so that would not really be binding, but I think there's an overall sense in all the statements that I've seen that they want to try to get to a shared position. We know from all kinds of other situations that it seems like the data protection authorities are getting increasingly, or it's going to, they find it increasingly hard to agree on things, and there's more readiness to do things on the respective DPA's own account. So I guess everybody's hoping right now that they will really come up with some guidance to provide at least some degree of certainty what this all means from the data protection authority's perspective.
But Martin, just to ask a basic question, I assume that the data protection authorities cannot get together and essentially overturn the ECJ decision and say, we are going to individually enforce safe harbor because we believe it's adequate. As I understand the decision, the ECJ has said that there are basic conflicts between U.S. and European law, and that would be binding on these DPAs. They can't essentially individually reinstitute safe harbor, but correct me if I'm wrong there.
No, that's not going to happen. It's more the other way around. Safe harbor is gone, and how far-reaching are the effects of safe harbor being gone for data transfers in general and for other means of transfer? We'll get to that in a minute, I guess. The authorities have been skeptical, or many of the authorities have been very skeptical of safe harbor for a number of years already. So they are in general saying, hey, we said this all along. This is not a good mechanism. We never liked it, and now it's over. And the press releases have some indication that the company should somehow really get started on thinking about alternative means, in a rather short notice.
So, Heather, maybe what types of...
One thing. There was also an initial press release by the European Commission very short time after the decision, where the Commission said that they are committed to help find solutions to keep data flows in place and find a way out. I see the data protection authorities to be in the key role here. The Commission is, of course, relevant and important, and they may be able to negotiate safe harbor number two or an alternative to that. Again, I'm most attentively watching the data protection authorities.
Okay, great. And we're going to turn to those different options and the pros cons of them in a minute. But first, Heather, did you just want to talk about what kind of companies need to worry about this decision and who it is applicable to?
Yeah, I think that that's actually an important point because there's been some confusion on this. I've actually talked with folks and had them say, oh, this decision doesn't have any impact on me. We're not safe harbor certified, or we're a financial institution. We can't certify under the safe harbor. But it's actually broader than that, and I think some folks might not be aware of the potential exposure that's here. Obviously, if you're safe harbor certified, there's a direct impact on you. It might not be terrible because you might have other mechanisms that also justify the transfer, so it's going to be company by company how big that impact is. I think the biggest impact, obviously, is on companies that don't rely on the safe harbor just for their internal transfers, but for, they have a business model where they have business customers that are sending them data. And so regardless of what we talk about here about the legal implications of the decision and whether DPAs are going to enforce against them, those companies have a business imperative now to find another solution or they could potentially lose customers. But I would note that it goes outside just those companies that are directly safe harbor certified. You know, even companies that are using consent model clauses or something else to get their data to the U.S., they don't keep it fully within the bounds of their company once it gets here. So oftentimes they send it on to service providers, HR, HR systems. They send it to entities that handle their customer relationship database. And those transfers need some sort of justification too. You know, if you've done the model clauses, for example, there are elements that specify that when you're transferring data on from your company to another one, you need to be transferring it to a company that has adequate data protection. And if you were relying on the safe harbor for that, and safe harbor's gone, you could potentially be in violation of EU law if you're sending it to another company that you don't have appropriate contractual provisions in place with.
Great. Let's jump into these other options that we keep referring to, but let's go through some of them and the pros, cons, and then also whether or not in a either short or intermediate term, or is the ECJ decision itself call into question some of these options. But first, maybe Martin, we could start with model clauses and what they are and how they're actually implemented by companies in terms of what the model clause option does.
Yes. So again, the directive said in general, data transfers to recipients outside the European Union are only allowed if the recipient or the recipient country has an adequate level of data protection in the European sense. As Heather mentioned, there's a few ways to achieve that compliance or that level of adequacy. The European Commission has declared a very few countries to be adequate and safe. Switzerland, for example, is a good example, or Argentina. Apart from the safe harbor, the so-called EU standard contractual clauses or EU model clauses are one of the options that are available and widely used. Structurally, it's kind of a similar thing. The European Commission has looked at a set of contractual clauses, or a complete contract, to be more precise, reviewed that and declared that companies that use these clauses or this standard contract in a manner that they are not modified in any way do provide an adequate level of protection of a recipient outside the EU. So the way this works very often in practice is the parties scramble to find a legal justification for a data transfer. They take this text, put in their names, need to fill out Appendix 1 and 2 to the thing, which describes the kind of data and the kind of processing activities and the IT security measures, sign it, and have a legal basis. This is not the way it's supposed to be done. Parties are supposed to read what they are signing in the first place. There's a couple of things in there which Barry alluded to that companies don't like, and that's why a lot of companies chose safe harbor. And it's sometimes not easy to identify who should actually be signing these standard contractual clauses. I guess the exporter, from a European perspective, is always a company that's based in the EU, and the importer is a company that's based outside the EU. So far, so easy. In outsourcing situations, things get more complicated. If you have a service provider in the EU that wants to then sub-process with somebody in India or in the US, or you have a outsourcing company that's in the US and then wants to sub-process to India, for example, so there's quite some difficulty at some point to really find who should be signing what. Final remark, there's not one set of standard contractual clauses, but three. Two of these apply to transfers between a controller in the EU and a controller outside of the EU. A controller being a company that uses the data on its own behalf and for its own purposes. So for transfers where the recipient really wants to do its own thing, these clauses are the right ones. The third set of EU standard contractual clauses is the controller processor transfer. That is closer to the classic outsourcing or cloud type of situation where a service provider processes personal data, but only processes on behalf of a controller and under the instructions and the directions of a controller. And there's a little different contractual language there.
And do we have, you mentioned the model clauses and what they actually require. Of course, as I understand it, the ECJ did not, of course, rule on the adequacy of these model clauses, but is there some question about these model clauses to the extent that
the ECJ decided that there were certain incompatibilities between U.S. and European law. Does that in any way call into question, perhaps, the text of these model clauses?
Yes. The good news is that in its judgment this week, the court said only the court can declare a European Commission decision to be invalid. So the model clauses are a different decision by the European Commission, so they are there and they are valid. And they will only become invalid if the European Court of Justice said they are invalid, not before that. And that will take time if it ever happens. Structurally, it's of course a bit tricky. I mean, it's also a Commission decision, and in the end, companies that transfer data to the U.S. based on the standard contractual clauses transfer the data to a country that the European Court just found to be not providing an adequate level of data protection. So, of course, there's some question on why should this still be possible if it wasn't possible under safe harbor. This is probably not really a short-term question, even though it is increasingly on minds of people who ask what's like the mid- or long-term perspective. My take would be in the short term, the model clauses are something that should be really seriously considered, but it may be that this whole story evolves further and the model clauses could be one of the next targets in the whole discussion and legal proceedings.
So, Heather, could you talk about in terms of working with clients, in terms of the pro and con, in terms of using the model clauses and thinking about that?
Yeah, and Barry, chime in, too. I know you've done a lot of work with folks with the model clauses in Safe Harbor, too. But, this isn't necessarily a panacea. One thing that a lot of folks liked about the Safe Harbor regime is that it was pretty easy to self-certify. If you were doing it right, there was a lot more involved, but it was easy to self-certify. So the model clauses in some countries you have to file them with the data protection authorities. In some countries you even have to get approval from the data protection authorities. And, that can take 60 days or more. So it's not like you can just sign these contracts and put them into place. There are other, it's hard to sign with every company. If you have, 1,000 clients, signing this 1,000 times with them can be complicated. And if there's no entity in the EU you can sign with, you have to have a data exporter to make these contracts work. So if you were relying on the Safe Harbor to get transfers from data subjects, for example, the model clauses aren't going to be an option for you. But we're trying to come up with creative ways of looking at the clauses because, of course, as Martin said, the way they're written, it's from an exporter in the EU to an importer elsewhere. And what do you do when you've already got the data in the U.S. and you're trying to send it on to a service provider? There are some ways that they can sign on to the clauses you've already done, but it's a complicated process. So it's certainly better than not having anything at all in place, but it's something that you have to give a lot of thought to whether it's the right option for you.
Right, and this is Barry. As Heather indicated, the model clauses present an option for many companies, but it is not a perfect one. For many companies that chose the safe harbor for whatever reason, the model clauses were considered to be the second best choice. Whether that second best choice is a feasible one is one that companies can now revisit because the safe harbor option is no longer on the table. Where the model clauses were a legitimate second choice and simply not as convenient as the safe harbor, companies may well be able to revisit that analysis and conclude that the model clauses can be implemented. As Heather indicated, it does present some logistical challenges, particularly if there are a large number of parties or if it is difficult to actually communicate with the parties to implement the contracts. But in a number of situations that we've seen, contracts could be entered into relatively straightforwardly, and that is certainly a path now that is available for entities that no longer have the ability to use Safe Harbor.
And it's probably the best path for entities that can't rely on another ground. So a lot of folks now are talking about getting consent from the data subjects in order to do the data transfer. But of course, some countries do not view consent from employees as freely given and valid. So in that case, to the extent that you're looking for an alternative, it could well be that the model clauses are best for you, especially since you control it. You know, you'd be on both ends of that contract.
So let's just pause there on consent for a minute. Heather, can you expand a little bit more on consent as an option? Is that a practical way for many companies to proceed in terms of, you know, just simply getting consent?
So it would be. If you have a direct relationship with the individual in question, so if you have a direct relationship with a consumer, you can seek their consent for the data transfer. As I said, and I'm sure that Martin and Hans can elaborate on this, in many cases, consent is not an option. In the employment context, in some jurisdictions within the EU, it's viewed that the employer relationship is sufficiently coercive that it's not freely given consent.
Yeah.
But it certainly, and Barry, if you have a view on that as well.
Yeah, many companies that could have obtained consent did the safe harbor anyway. Many companies obtained consent and still did the safe harbor. So if consent is feasible, as Heather noted, if you can literally reach out to those individuals to obtain consent, that is now an option. But for many companies that elected the safe harbor, one of the reasons they did that was because obtaining consent was never really a feasible choice. And so for those companies, consent is not going to offer much of a relief.
Yeah. Martin and Hans, I wanted to pause and see if you wanted to weigh in on consent, because I think there might be some cultural differences between what we consider consent in the United States and what certain countries in Europe may consider consent when we use that term.
Yes, Germany is a tough one on consent because the data protection authorities have been pushing the bar up and up and up to get to valid consent. I mean, the consent has to be informed. So in a way, you could argue that if a German employer now goes to an employee and says, "Look, we need to consent that we have a consolidated HR database in the United States," what are you going to tell the employee? Your data is going to be subject to limitless spying by all kinds of American Secret Service type of authorities. In the current mood in Europe, no offense to the American intelligence gathering here, but that is kind of the political mood right now. And there's some people even saying that this kind of far-reaching consent cannot be validly given, which I take to be more of a German discussion, so I wouldn't overdo that. But still, the former Federal Data Protection Commissioner of Germany, who was the commissioner until a year ago, kind of said even consent is not really an option. I would also add that I have usually told clients, look very careful whether you want to work with consent, because consent can also be withdrawn. And that may be fine for certain companies where you say, well, you can't use our services anymore. But for an employee who says, I want to withdraw my consent, there usually needs to be a plan B, what to do then. And then to have a second HR database in Europe for those employees who have not provided consent is not really an option. So it's tough. Again, if there are direct relationships with customers or users and regularly updated terms and conditions, and whether it's an app or a website or whatever, there are probably means and options to just have the existing users to agree yet another time to new terms and conditions and the new privacy policy and whatever else. But for everybody else, it's going to be really tough to use that in an effective manner.
And let's just talk about a couple of the other options, I think, just briefly, because I don't know how practical some of them are. But, Martin, in terms of what are called binding corporate rules or BCRs, we understand that those can take a long time to put in place and may not be practical for a number of clients, but just wanted to mention it as an option because it is something that is, you know, often discussed. And just wanted to know if you could just briefly discuss the BCR process.
Yes, the so-called BCRs or binding corporate rules have been very popular among the European data protection authorities. So they have been very active in encouraging companies to go through that process. That process works in a way that a group of companies can come up with a document that is then binding corporate rules, so a set of rules how the company wants to treat data, and then go through a process within the EU and the data protection authorities to get a formal approval of these binding corporate rules. And once all the relevant data protection authorities have agreed to them, data is supposed to flow freely or fairly freely within that group of companies. That used to be a process that would take 5, 6, 7 years. Mercedes is one of the earlier companies who did that, and they took forever. It's now getting better because the data protection authorities have really tried to streamline the process to get to that. But I would still think 2 years is probably still an estimate that everybody has to work with. And the second thing is it's only data flows within the company. So all the relationship, as Heather pointed out, with the outside service providers would have to be addressed in a different way. The latest and greatest iteration of this binding corporate rules thing is binding corporate rules for processors. So processors can also certify, and then you can again reduce the number of challenges here, but it's a process that still a limited number of companies have done. It's great once you have it, but it's a big project to get there.
Great. Okay. And I know that there's some other options that may work in certain situations, but I don't think we're going to spend a lot of time on here, but we're happy to discuss and follow up in terms of anonymization and some other options. But instead, I thought I'd put Heather on the spot and say, so Heather, We've just laid out a whole series of options and why there's not necessarily an ideal path forward. We're waiting to see what the DPAs are going to do. We're going to talk in a minute here about what private parties may start to do in Europe and get some insights from Hans on that and why there may not be some ideal path there even with the DPAs. So, you know, clients are asking, where are we then? You've laid out all of these options and said, well, this may not work, this may not work. So what should we be doing today here at 12:40 Eastern if I'm in a company and everyone's asking me how should we react to this decision and what should I do in the coming weeks?
Right. So I think that if you can draw anything out of the conversation that we've had so far, it's that the answer varies a lot by company, right? Some of the companies are fine now, even if they were relying on the safe harbor because they have other mechanisms. So I think really what folks need to do right now is evaluate. They need to look and see, what are my data flows from Europe? What are my data flows outside of Europe once it gets to another jurisdiction? Do an inventory. Most folks actually have an inventory like that, or they should if they've got data coming from the EU because they have obligations with respect to it. But oftentimes they haven't gone granular to the point of this was justified by consent and safe harbor. This piece of it is subject to our model clauses. This agreement with this vendor is, you know, we have model clauses in place. This one we have safe harbor. This one there was some other justification. So I think evaluation stage is absolutely what people need to be doing right now. I think as far as the next step to take, it's going to be company dependent, and we'll know a lot more next week when we hear more out of the DPAs. Again, we'll know how urgent this is, but I think there is an urgent need to take stock now. I don't know if you need to run and jump into the clauses or something like that. It'll depend on the company, but there is a need to take stock now.
Right. Yeah, this is Barry. I would add the UK Office of the Information Commissioner has issued a statement not to panic. And while I think everyone should take that to heart, as Heather indicated, that doesn't mean we should just sit, do nothing, and hope that the EU authorities come up with a generous plan for transition. Instead, as Heather indicated, this is a time to evaluate. But for many companies that selected Safe Harbor in particular and find that they're now no longer on they're on the list, but that list no longer means anything in the EU, it is not necessarily a time to start all over. In fact, many companies can simply go back and think, why did I enroll in the safe harbor in the first place? And as I indicated earlier, if the safe harbor was an attractive, Americanized version of EU data protection that was more appealing than the model clauses, those companies should now work to revisit whether the model contracts or the standard clauses will work for them. As Martin indicated, the binding corporate rules is and always was a long-term strategy. That's not going to provide any help in the coming weeks. But companies can use this as an opportunity to simply revisit, why did I do safe harbor? I can't do safe harbor now. So if I elected not to do the standard clauses, was it because I didn't want to or because they wouldn't work? And if it was simply less convenient, that is still an option. And that, for many companies, is the best option that's currently available while we're waiting for guidance from the EU authorities.
Hans, I wondered if you could talk a minute about what the penalties are, what the powers of the data protection authorities are for data flows, but also talk about the role of private parties here. Of course, you know, the case itself was brought by a private party, and even if the data protection authorities want to wait some time before kind of wading into this, what the role of private parties in bringing actions can be in the various jurisdictions.
Yeah, many thanks. Like, we would generally distinguish between a public law route and a civil law route here. Like, we had the DPA here acting, and like, my personal view would be that over the next days, the DPAs may take a strong position on substance, but would not really overdo it in terms of enforcing that heavily. Like, we have seen in Germany cases, we're working on cases where DPAs in terms of alleged data protection violations have gone and have issued orders and have enforced them immediately. That is probably the most heavy sanction a DPA would normally go for. I would not assume that they really go for such immediately enforcement right now. If time moves forward, that may change if no solutions will be presented. I am a bit more concerned about private civil actions. Mr. Schrems, as you may know, has not only applied to the Irish Data Protection Commissioner, but has also already brought civil lawsuits in Austria before the Austrian civil courts, asking for damages. As most of you or all of you are aware, like, the damage laws in Europe, or in most countries of the European Union, perhaps except for England, are much less strict than in the US. We do not know treble damages. People have to really demonstrate the actual damage that they have suffered. So, the risk of facing really serious amounts of damages are rather low. What is more problematic or of concern is that that those private plaintiffs, and we see some consumer protection associations which have gone over recent years already against some alleged data protection violations, that these bring cases and a request for prohibition of transfer or a cease and desist declaration not to transfer data into the U.S. unless there are proper mechanisms in place. And here, again, what I mentioned before, the existing decision of the European Commission as regards the standard clauses is certainly of at least temporary help, yeah, because it would be difficult for national courts to just adopt a or issue a prohibition order without taking that that if someone relies on standard contractual clauses, without bringing that case again to the European Court of Justice and asking to evaluate whether these standard contractual clauses would still be in violation of the European data protection rules. So that could happen like interim suspensions of transfers could be requested by private parties. We have a very, put it negatively or positively, however you would see it, a very effective court system where such decisions could be taken within a few days, very, very quickly, and that is probably of more concern over time, and this is why we all look very, very curiously to what the Commission does in the next days and weeks, and how the data protection authorities will react in order to, hopefully calm down the overall situation.
Thanks. And I think with that concludes our discussion today. We appreciate everyone joining us. We realize that this is going to depend on breaking developments over the coming weeks, and we will try to reach out and keep you informed. And please reach out to us if you have any of the presenters, if you have any questions at any point in time. Thanks again for your attendance and participation today.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your line.